There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1108, August 18th, 2025, Stephen.
This is F1 Weekly Podcast brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads bring you the F1Weekly.com web server for the ads that interest you. From Danica's tantrums to Danny's smiles, Yahoo Ads give you the stuff you really want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Yahoo Ads. On today's program, we have another special summer break feature. Nasser talks about Vettel over Mark Webber era. The first tech talk with Tim, very exciting. And we bring back Tom Dillman, the Frenchman that sounds British. And yes, we have our interview this week, F1 Weekly family people. I would say, yes, indeed, Derek and Connor Daly. Great interview. Derek really gets into the meat and potatoes of Formula One. It's very, very cool. And yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, we do need your contributions to keep this program up on the cloud. So please click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know, you'll want to. So there you have it. Not much going on. Max stays put. Everybody's calm. We know it's all about McLaren. And, you know, Zach Brown's been over here for the Monterey Car Week. Every time I turn on TV, Zach Brown is getting interviewed. And apparently now McLaren is offering futures on purchasing future Formula One cars. So very interesting stuff. Enjoy. The Motorsports Mondiale Nasser is enlightening because he talks about a moment with Mark Webber, that era with Vettel really dominating, almost cold-blooded, but this shaped Webber, and this is how Webber is communicating to Oscar Piastri. Webber's lived it. Oscar is now in charge. So keep that in mind, and don't forget, Nass, I think about you every day. Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
This edition of F1 Weekly Podcast is brought to you by your neighborhood Panda Express. Grab some Beijing beef and chop chop. Enjoy the Grand Prix in Shanghai.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Sebastian Vettel says Webber deserves nothing, and I'll do it again. Kimi Raikkonen already rumored to replace the infamous Mark Webber at Red Bull. And Ferrari's Fernando Alonso says he will follow orders. And of course, we've got Motorsports Mondial with the king of Karachi himself, Nasser Hamid. And another fantastic episode from Tim, the tech dude, Tim Schwartz.
Tech Talk from Tim, it's called.
Tech Talk from Tim. Thanks. Welcome to the studio, Nasser. How are you?
Very good, sir. Thank you. Good to see you again. And as usual, the atmosphere is very loving for Formula One in the Palatial Studios. We have Formula Uno. Chop Chop is the story of Mark Webber ever since Sebastian Vettel joined that team. What say you?
Oh, it's unbelievable. And now Vettel, of course, you know, they're all in China right now. We're getting ready for the Grand Prix de Chine. And of course, in beautiful downtown Shanghai, where anything is very, very hard to see because there's so much smog, but still, what a loving and passionate crowd for motorsports.
Yeah, you know, the story that I heard, it's a rumor that once upon a time before Sebastian Vettel joined Red Bull from Toro Rosso, Christian Horner took both drivers to a Chinese restaurant in Milton Keynes. When Weber opened his fortune cookie, it says, "You will have a fast teammate soon."
That's so touching and beautiful.
It is.
Poor Mark Weber. But still, Vettel coming out in the press on Thursday in China saying, "You know what? In the end, I'll probably do it again because Mark Weber hasn't done anything to help me out." So in other words, this guy now is vicious, he's mean, he's Teutonic, and he's going for the Blitzkrieg on Formula One.
You think he should just shave off his beard and just leave a little mustache?
See, I never said that. But I think he's listening to German marching music and Wagner.
Well, they're already making references to German Austro Alliance and what that can, what damage that can do. But, you know, talking strictly motor racing, I'm not surprised. You know what happens? A good driver always knows how good he is. And especially if you're in the same team. And I've said this many times before, and I'll say it one more time. When this kid joined Red Bull, there was an interview shown before long before the season started. It was like, I don't know, garden or backyard or whatever. He's sitting there on a sofa with Mark Webber. And it's just the confidence, what you can call it, arrogance, or whatever you want to call it. But it just looked, you know, first thing out of his mouth was, first person you want to beat is your teammate. So he came with an agenda, he's racing with an agenda, and yeah, he's right, he's going to do it again. Lewis Hamilton is on the same program. I think Alonso, if he's in the position, he will do the same thing. We all know what Senna and Schumacher were capable of. The only real good guys are people like Massa, Jenson, Button. And I'm going to tell you, if they are in a very feisty competitive mood and championship is at stake, their true colors will also come out. So with some drivers, it comes out first few races, first few seasons. Some other people, it takes time. But Robin Miller loves to say hate is good for racing. So let's see what happens.
I agree. No, I do think hate is good for racing. Other people are saying that Mark Webber is beginning to prepare his finale in Formula One. In other words, his retirement at the end of the season. And just recently, one of your favorite restaurants in
Stag.
The UK, the Stag, was shut down. Nobody got paid. And there's rumors that his home in England is also up for sale. He's bought a new home in Australia with a big jacuzzi. Lots of preparation for no more UK for Mark Webber. What do you think this points to?
Well, you know, he's from Australia, so him going back home will not be a surprise when his racing days are over. Has been very successful, great guy, good guy from all angles we hear about him. And it's, you know, it would have been good for the sport had he won the championship, you know, first Australian world champion since 1980. But, you know, he's done what he could do, and now I think it will be good to go out gracefully, even though, you know, he's under fire from all sides. And the thing is, you know, if there are 20 races in a season and they have a competitive car, Sebastian Vettel knows that the call from Mark Webber saying not bad for a number two driver may come two or three times in a season. You know what I'm saying? And he's going to win majority of the races anyway. I mean, the guy won, I think, gave Red Bull the first win in only his third start, if I recall correctly. So, you know, I don't want this thing going out in a very bad, like Reutemann and Jones situation or the Alonso and Hamilton situation, even though it makes up a good headline. But I would like to see this guy go out gracefully, win a few races. But can he beat Sebastian Vettel in a straight fight over a course of season? That would be like Nico Rosberg beating Lewis Hamilton. Most probably will not happen. Can't guarantee that. Okay, sir. Now, also, you know, GP3 will race in Valencia at the Ricardo Tormo circuit. So this will be like a one-off deal, not with GP2 and Formula Uno. In other news, you know, talking of ladies, Patrick and Susie Wolf, you know, there's a lady, we've reported on her a few times, young 18-year-old, Betske Visser. She's from the Netherlands. She has now been inducted into the Red Bull program, and I think she has done very well in karting, and she was racing in a series called Formula ADAC, ADAC in Germany, which is like a Formula 2 liter car, something like that, and did pretty decent. I think this girl is very quick, like Simona Di Silvestro on the track. And there is another Dutch, you know this guy, Robin Vriens, who won 3 championships in a 3-row. He's Dutch. And there's another guy from the Netherlands, young kid, Nick De Vries. He's in Formula Renault, Eurocup. I think these people will do very well. Other names to watch this year in Junior Formula, as most of these series are now starting or have just started. Stoffel Vandoorne, Kevin Magnussen, and Antonio Felix da Costa, they are all racing in World Series by Renault, Formula Renault 3.5. I will not be surprised at all if Felix da Costa wins the championship. And Kevin Magnussen, he's in his second year. He really needs to fight for the championship, and he's a good talent. I think he will. And Stoffel Vandoorne, man, if he can pull off a championship success in his first year, just like Robin Vriens, against other talented driver and experienced driver, it will do him very good. Now in GP2, or as we say here,
Rapidos,
battle of the veterans between Stefano Coletti and Fabio Limer. I think both these youths are in their fourth year of GP2, and both are pretty quick. And the tussle between 2 second-year drivers, which I'm following with a lot of interest, James Calado, who's from UK, and cousin Felipe Nasser from Brazil. And I think the rookie to watch this year could be Daniel Abt. Last year as a rookie, he almost won the GP3 title. And let's see what happens. It's a long, long season. Now, Jack Hawksworth racing, young junior Formula on this side of the pond. Jack Hawksworth in Indy Lights, where he won the season opener in St. Pete. I think he's the man headed for a future. Now, this is one of those things, you know, if this guy wins this championship, 2 championship and 2 rookie season, I frankly will not be surprised if that happened, that he gets a call from Roger Penske people or Chip Ganassi, because success breeds success.
Not from Eric Bouliguer?
No, I think because of the age and he's winning on this side of the pond. The only way a Formula team will call somebody who's racing here, if they win, 15 of 20 races. But that thing, you know, that has been done, you know. J.R. Hildebrand won a lot of races in Formula Renault. But then people, you know, if you do the same thing in British Formula 3 or World Series by Renault, if you have a dominating performance, people are going to say, who was your talent? What was the talent, the competition like? I mean, you know, like some years ago, I think it was 2 years ago when they had Rossi, Wickens, and several other top-line drivers, Jean-Eric Van Ricciardo and World Series by Renault. If you're winning against heavy talent, that will help. But winning against Carlos Munoz and, Daniel Tarantula, that's not going to get you a call from Luke.
Of course.
Would you call a guy who wins a lot of races against drivers you've never heard of if you were in charge of Renault Motorsports?
I would never do that.
You would only call guys who have names like Jean-Pierre and, you know, Enrique de la Traz, right?
Exactly.
Yes, sir. Okay. In Formula One, our man, gentleman we've been following for many years, Jules Bianchi, is already impressing a lot of people. And I'm sure, moving forward, Sebastian Vettel will remain on the Lola program. The song, not the car.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets.
So there you have it for Motorsports Mondial. Any thoughts on in the world of motorsports that you would like to say or speak out or whatever?
Well, I think Juan Pablo Montoya is a big disappointment, but he loves the hot dogs. So 26 means nothing. He gets to go home to Miami and have sausages.
Yes. You know, when I'm talking of him, I was at Daytona for the 24-hour race. I saw his brother, Federico Montoya, and at one time, he was racing in Formula BMW, but the two apples, you know, they're from the same tree. One went in the right direction, the other went and started circling. So he's still circling.
Absolutely outstanding Motorsports Mondial. Thanks again, Nasser. And now, let's introduce this fine French gentleman.
Tom Dillman, young Francais from the Alsace region, which is also home to Mr. Loeb of WRC fame, Ivan Müller. Tom is a talented driver who has been in and out of racing due to sponsorship issues. This season, he is having the Russian time of his life. And the interesting thing about him, he comes back and is successful very quickly, wins a race or is in the top three very quickly. So I'm hoping that he enjoys his Russian time and gets the success he deserves. And so please enjoy the conversation. And for more info, visit his website. Thank you, Mr. Tom, and thank you, listeners.
Okay, folks, I'm here with a talented young Frenchman, Mr. Tom Dillman. Tom, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you today?
Really good. Looking forward to race two.
How did the race one in Sepang go for you?
Not so good. Many things went wrong. The pace was really good. I was running P6. Then we had a long pit stop, a drive-through. So, a bit disappointing, but we'll do better today.
I've been following your career for a few years. You are in out because of sponsorship issues. This year you're with Russian Time. Tell us how this deal came together and what is the deal for the full season or what's going on.
Yeah, I struggled many years with budget issues, so I could never do a full season. I got opportunities there, and like that I managed to step by step to go to GP2. And this season I got a last minute deal with Russian Time for the full season. It was quite unexpected. I was honestly trying to do another championship like Porsche Super Cup to try and be professional, because single seater budget is so high that it was unrealistic. And I was invited to the test in RRS with Ilmer. It went very well. Then I was invited to test with Russian Time. It went well, and so I got the drive.
Russian Time means, does that mean a lot of free vodka?
I don't know, vodka, Kalashnikov.
Kalashnikov? Wow, you're on the right track, boy. Okay. Okay, a question for you. Tell us a little bit about your early... How did you get involved in motor racing? Was there interest in the family, or is this something you picked up on your own?
Yeah, my father was racing. He was, but he was doing everything. He was building his own car, driving as well. So, I was born on racetrack, let's say. So, when my father stopped, when I was 10, then I started to race.
Okay. And how long were you in karting?
Only 3 years.
These days, drivers do a lot in many years, 5-6 years in karting. You're 3 years in karting. Was that enough for you, or do you think you should have stayed a few more years in karting?
Actually, because my father had experience in with race cars and not so much in go-karts, we decided to go to single-seater quite early. So I was always doing it with my father, you know, go-karts. And then my first year in single-seater was also with my father, because it was easier for him to run a car than a go-kart, actually. So, that's why at 14 I was in a single-seater already.
Now, when you switch from karting to single-seater, did you find the adjustment very hard, or was it the same thing for you?
Well, it was not really hard. No.
No problem? Okay. Now, you spent 3 years in 2004 to 2006 in Formula Renault. Tell us who were the drivers you raced against and what were your high points when you were in Formula Renault?
I raced with Baguette, with Baguette from...
Bertrand Baguette. He's very tasty.
Yeah, you know him from IndyCar, I guess, so that's why I see him. Yeah, I mean, Buemi, Aguirre-Zoari, all those guys, you know, Grosjean.
Who did you, when you were racing against those guys, who did you think was really quick?
I would say Grosjean and Hülkenberg.
Hülkenberg? Now, in those days, I'm sure Grosjean was Swiss.
He was Swiss in Formula Renault and French in F3. Yeah,
yeah, I find that very interesting. Okay, now, when you stepped up to F3 Euro Series, obviously a very big series in those days, even now, how big was the challenge and the depth of competition for you compared to days in Formula Renault?
Yeah, EuroCup Formula Renault was already a high-level championship with four, 35 cars, you know. But the Euro Series at this time was the highest-level series for young drivers. That was all the Red Bull, Toyota, Renault, Mercedes drivers. I was the youngest driver. I was 18. But it went okay. I had 3 podiums. Unfortunately, at the beginning of the season, I had a big crash. I broke my sternum and 2 vertebra, so I was 2 months on the sideline. I missed the first race. The season went okay for a rookie. It was good.
What caused your accident? Driver error, somebody crashing, or a mechanical issue?
Yeah, just a crash in testing.
for example. Okay, now you switched from F3 Euro Series to German F3. Was that because of sponsorship issues?
Yeah, after 2007, after my first year in Euro Series, I had budget issue. I lost Red Bull after a few races in 2008, because also I had to bring a part of the budget, which I didn't find. And after I raced just there and there in Euro Series, and then I had no budget at all, and I was invited by teams in Formula 3 that wanted to improve the car and the results. So it always went well. So I got other more drives in F3, and I finally got a full year in F3 in German F3, which I won. So
Now you had 6 wins and you were on the podium in half the races. What were the best wins for you?
Anyways, this championship, it was all about winning the championship. If I was second, it would have been last for me, because stepping down from Euro Series and with the experience, and the only goal was to win. So it's to win the championship that was the main thing.
Okay, good. Now in 2011 you were in GP3. How does that car compare to the F3 car, and how was your season in GP3?
The car for me was too easy to drive. That means it was very hard for a driver to make the difference. It was all about the team. I did the first race with Carlin, I did pole, and then I finished on the podium. But again, budget issues made that I couldn't continue. So then I finished the season with Adax. Was always quick in qualifying, but in the races we always struggled with the tires. So at the end, my position in the championship was quite bad.
Now, last year you won a race in GP2. How was that feeling like? Because that's as big as you can get before you get to Formula 1.
Yeah, it was great, because end of 2011 I got the opportunity to finally drive a GP2. And I also made my first race in Abu Dhabi. I finished on the podium on my first weekend. And then it was again looking quite difficult for the 2012 season because of budget issues. So so I got always last-minute drives, on the Thursday before the weekend. And but to have a win, especially as a rookie, I was the only one with Calado to have a win as a rookie. So it was great, and that helped me to get the drive this year as well.
I watched that race on the web, and I was very happy for you. It was a very impressive win. Now you mentioned about Red Bull. How did you join that group? Did they call you, or you called them? Tell us a little bit background on how you got into Red Bull.
Yeah, actually, my first contact with Helmut Marko was on the starting grid. So I was sitting in the car next to another Red Bull driver on the front row, and that's the first time he came to speak to me to say he would like to invite me to a shootout in Estoril, and that went very well, and I got the contract.
Okay. And when they let you go, was that strictly because you couldn't come up with part of the sponsorship?
I had to find half of the budget for the season in Euro Series, which was quite a lot. I was in a new team, and I tried to find this budget, but I couldn't find it. So I was just hoping to have great results, that they keep me, but unfortunately I had no great results. The team was new, and it was, it was... I couldn't do good results, and so I was out because I didn't find the budget.
Now, like today, in England, they have a program called Racing Steps Foundation. They help young talented driver like James Calado. And in the old days, Elf, Renault used to help a lot of French driver. This French organization, FFSA, are they providing any financial assistance to talented drivers, young drivers like you?
Driver like me, no. They help some drivers. I think they help Bianchi, but they never helped me ever.
Now, please tell our listeners a little bit about Tom Dillman, the person, young man, not the driver. What kind of food, what kind of music you like, and stuff like that?
I like all kind of music, hip-hop, rock, electro, and actually I like food a lot. It doesn't look like, but I like to eat a lot, and I think compared to the other driver, I had so many troubles, and I struggled so much during my career to race, that I'm really hungry, and So yeah, that's maybe the difference with the other.
Okay. Now we do a program from California. Have you ever been to the United States, and do you follow American racing scene?
Yeah, I'm a big motorsport fan, so I follow everything. I follow IndyCar. Actually, I'm not into NASCAR. I never watched a race actually, but yeah, IndyCar or even ALMS, I follow.
Great. Okay, you're from the Alsace region of France. Have you ever met your famous homeboy, Mr. Sebastian Loeb?
Yeah, I met him already, of course. And yeah, it's great, you know. In my area, we have many good drivers. We have Sebastian Loeb, Yvan Muller, who's a touring car world champion. And also Bruno Spengler, the DTM driver, is also from my area. So, yeah.
Okay, finally, how about a message for our listeners? We have listeners all over the world. Tell them about your website also, please.
My website is www.tomdillmann.com with two L and two N. So, yeah, I hope you will follow me, and yeah, I hope to make a good show on track. I am Tom Dillmann, and you are listening to F1 Weekly.
Merci beaucoup, monsieur.
Tom Dillmann, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. And now, it's time for Tech Talk with Tim.
Yes, sir. Thanks to Tim Schwartz, one of the original listeners and now studying at the Stanford University and enjoying fine international cuisine from Peru to Pakistan and from Lima to Lisbon. And we shall be getting together soon for another fine international dining experience. We want to thank him for his input here and also bringing in more people to the show. And I understand he recently had a nice chat up close, and I don't know how personal, with Desiree.
You mean the femme fatale?
Exactly.
Yes, yes, Desiree doing some community charity work, apparently.
Spreading the love.
Spreading the love. Met with young Tim. And I heard everything was okay. He's still an innocent young man. So, Tim, keep up the good work. And thanks for sharing your tips this week with Tech Talk on F1Weekly.com.
This is Tim's Tech Talk. Greetings, F1 Weekly. This is Tim here, bringing you a new monthly segment called Tech Talk. I'm an aerospace engineer and a longtime fan of Formula One, so I'm pleased to be able to relate some technical concepts that will hopefully enhance your understanding and appreciation of the engineering wizardry of Formula One. We're nearing the end of the off-season, and that means that the work of hundreds of dedicated engineers is allowing cars to be rolled out and tested. And as you may have heard, one of the crucial tools in the design process is CFD. So what is CFD? Let's start with the basics. CFD stands for Computational Fluid Dynamics. The first word, computational, means that this is a technique that uses computers to carry out calculations. CFD can be used to study the aerodynamics of a car part long before it is ever actually produced, saving time and money. Many versions of a part can be compared in a computer before the design is optimized and finally built. The second word, fluid, means that CFD is used to study liquids and gases, as opposed to analysis of a solid material, like the strength of the car's nose during a crash. In the case of Formula One, the main fluid studied is, of course, air, but CFD can also be used to study fuel or oil flow, and CFD is an equally valuable tool in other fields, such as boat design or the design of medical devices. And finally, the D is for dynamics, which means that the air is moving. And if your car is not moving, CFD alone will not solve your problems. The roots of CFD date back to the 1930s, but decades later, it was computers that really gave CFD the power to become a useful tool. Computers are perfect for doing simple calculations millions and millions of times. So how does CFD work? The approach is pretty logical and simple. Instead of trying to figure out a complex airflow, CFD breaks the space around the car into tiny boxes. Boxes so tiny that the airflows inside are quite simple. Thousands or even millions can be used, although it's usually not necessary to model the flow over an entire car at once. Instead, the flow around a single piece or a group of pieces of the car, such as the exhaust pipes or a wing, can be studied independently. Inside each tiny box, which moves along with the car, simple rules must be followed. Here's an example. No air is created or destroyed inside a box. Air can flow into a box from a neighboring box, and then it can either stay there or leave. In aerodynamics speak, that's called conservation of mass. Here's another rule called flow tangency. That's a big term for a very simple concept. It means that air doesn't pass through a solid surface. When you look at the air next to any solid structure, be it a wing, a tire, or even the driver's helmet, the air can flow around the surface, but not into the surface. This seems pretty obvious. Otherwise, liquid would leak right out of pipes, for example. But what you have to remember is that if a computer isn't instructed to follow a rule, the computer won't. It doesn't have any experience in the real world. From these rules, and a few others, which you can find online or in any aerodynamics textbook, the computer can calculate air flows around the car, or a particular element of the car, and determine the forces, which you're probably already familiar with. There's drag, which resists the car's forward motion, and downforce, which pushes the car toward the ground. CFD also predicts the temperature of the air touching the car at each location, and that's useful in deciding which materials to use. The time for the calculations to be performed can be as much as hours or even days, depending on the computer used and the complexity and the number of parts to be studied. I recommend you do a quick online search for CFD images, because CFD is famous for producing beautiful images of airflows within or around cars or aircraft, with different colors representing air pressure, temperature, or speed. CFD is an extremely active area of research today. Some of the goals include faster computation time and more accurate computations of turbulent flows, which are not smooth. Well, that's it for this week's discussion. Comments, questions, suggestions for technical stuff you'd like to hear more about next time? Let me know on the forum. My username is BMW85. Cheers!
Hi, this is Alexander Rossi, 2008 Formula BMW, America's and World Final Champion, and you're listening to F1Weekly.com.
There you have it, NASA, another outstanding podcast for our listeners.
I'll tell you, I do feel sorry for Mark Webber, because I think he's a pretty good driver. He's a good guy, always comes up, always available to the media. You know, it's one of those things, you know, you sacrifice anything and everything, you break your leg, come back to Formula One after all these teams and all these years you've driven for, you finally get a winning package, and you got a cage rattler as a teammate.
Exactly. And you've got probably the top three fastest guy on the grid in the car next to you.
Yeah, he's rare talent. And this is the same thing happened to poor Elio De Angelis. He was in his fifth year of Lotus, playing second fiddle to Nigel Mansell, hoping he'll be number one, get all the goodies and all the best engineers. And in walks in Ayrton Senna da Silva. Party was over, opening round. But that's the way. That's this business. You got to make the most. It's going back to the days when Michael had the best package. Well, do the best you can. Otherwise, like you said about Massa, quite a few people out there think he may not get that opportunity. And unless you're in a very competitive car, nobody wins, including you-know-who. Yes, say no more. Okay, now, this is interesting. We're going to look at some drivers who gave three different teams their first Grand Prix victory. And in all the broadcasts I heard, I was really disappointed that Dan Gurney's name was not mentioned, and we'll show you why. Okay, these are drivers who gave three different teams their first win. We shall start with Sir Stirling Moss. He gave Van Wall their first win in a shared drive with Tony Brooks at Aintree in 1957. His 1958 victory in Argentina was the first for Cooper and also the first for a rear-engine car. And in 1960 Monaco Grand Prix, he gave Lotus cars their first win. Car was entered by Rob Walker Racing. Team Lotus had to wait till the first Watkins Glen Grand Prix in 1961 to score their maiden win. And actually, I believe Rob Walker entered Lotus one, two, or three races before Lotus was able to get a win on their own. But they had Stirling Moss, so it makes a difference. Dan Gurney, the ever-smiling gentleman from Newport Beach, California, gave Porsche their one and only win at Rouen in the 1962 French Grand Prix. 2 years later, at the same track, he recorded Brabham's first win, and in 1967 flew his own eagle to victory at Spa. Very, very impressive. Jackie Stewart, his winning contribution saw Matra in Holland 1968, March in Spain 1970, and Tyrrell again in Spain the following year. All
recorded their first win courtesy of the wee bit safety conscious Scottish driver. So all these people have a lot of historical contribution to motor racing. In an interesting side note, this is what I was talking earlier, the first 1-2 for Team Lotus was in the 1967 US Grand Prix at Watkins Glen, Jim Clark over Graham Hill. And before we get to our interview segment, come to a segment called Lap Ahead, where we look at upcoming events this weekend. One is for Formula One, so Bahrain Grand Prix from BIC, Bahrain International Circuit. A is for Argentina, that's where the WRC boys will be in action. G is for Grand Am, NASCAR Sports Car Series in action at Virginia International Raceway. I for Indy Cars at Kansas Speedway. Wonder if there will be dust in the wind. You know that song, right?
One of my favorites.
Very good. You have quite a few favorites like me. That's good. M is for MotoGP and Motegi in Japan. And N can only be for NASCAR. Boys will be in Sweet Home, Alabama at Talladega, where the PBR is blue and the government is true. Or so they say.
Keep up the good work, Nasser. Thank you for another outstanding Motorsports Mondial. And now stay tuned for the interviews after this brief message.
You are listening to F1 Weekly. We invite you to visit our forum page. Topics range from Fangio to Fisico and from baked beans to racing scene.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now for another special F1Weekly.com interview. And now we're talking about a father and son reunion. Nass, please introduce these two gentlemen.
Yes, sir. Thank you. This is with Derek Daly and Connor Daly. Derek is the dad and Connor is the young American kid. Derek Daly made it, you know, names like Derek Daly takes me back to the, for me, the golden era of motor racing, the early 70s, when I started following this beautiful sport. So Derek Daly made it to Formula One on the Devo program, worked in iron ore mines of Australia to go motor racing, raced with Williams and Tyrrell in Formula One, and then raced for many years in IndyCars. He is now based in Indianapolis, and his company, Derek Daly Design, is involved in designing racetracks around the world. And I would encourage our listeners to check out his website, which is www.derekdailydesign.com. The second part of the interview is with his son, Connor. Connor is 17 years old, and after a winning career in karting, he is now rapidly climbing the single-seater ladder. In 2008, he won the Skip Barber Championship with 5 wins. Representing Team USA, also won the Walter Hayes Formula Ford 1600 trophy at Silverstone. This year, he's taking part in Star Mazda Series, and his website is www.connordaily.net, and Connor is spelled C-O-N-O-R in his case. My sincere thanks to Derek. I really enjoyed talking to him and to his son, Connor, and I want to thank them again for their time at Sebring, which is where this conversation took place. Thank you.
Okay, folks, I'm here with Derek Daly, a gentleman who went to Australia to work in coal mines to go motor racing. And I love that story. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
It was a case back then where you just did whatever you had to do to get a chunk of cash if you wanted to buy a racing car. And I heard about an opportunity. I could either go to the iron ore mines in Australia or the oil fields of Alaska. The choice to go to the iron ore mines was made because we had to spend £1,000 for clothing to keep us warm in Alaska, and they were going to take that out of our pay pack. And we thought, nah, that's no good. We need all the money. So we just cut the legs off our pants and cut the sleeves off our shirts, and we were perfectly dressed for working in the mines in Australia.
How long were you there?
6 months of the winter of 73-74.
And how much of 6 months of coal mine working in the mine brought you in terms of racing time?
Well, what it allowed me to do is I came back with £5,000, which in those days was $10,000, and I'd never seen that amount of money before, and so that allowed me to buy a Formula Ford, which put me on the track to winning the Irish Formula Ford Championship. Then I had a valuable championship-winning car, which I sold. Got reasonable money for that, and was going to be able to use that for the following season, which was 76 in England. and I had enough money to either race or to live, but I really couldn't do both at the same time. So to live, I just bought an old school bus, took all the seats out of it, put two ramps in the back, and ran the racing car into the middle of it, and I had a toolbox, a racing car, and a sleeping bag, and my mother made curtains for the bus. My dad made a sponge mattress, and I said goodbye to my family, and that was it. I went to England to become a professional.
And you made it to Formula One. What was the highlight for you in your Formula One days?
I suppose the highlight was making it that far, because I came from such a basic non-motorsports background. Events like the British Grand Prix, I finished fourth in the Tyrrell. I can still remember some of the corners in that car. Driving the Williams, places like Monaco, leading Monaco in 1982, about to start the last lap, the gearbox broke. That's pretty heady times to live through for someone who came from the background I came from. And then just to have the ability to mix with those type of people, really people that you thought were on a different level until you got there. And then, of course, I went to the Indy 500 because I was intrigued by this racing at 200 miles an hour between a concrete wall. It just didn't make sense to me, and the speeds were so high. I went there in 83 for curiosity, and I never left. I've been there ever since.
Now, is Formula One really as intense, and it is what it is, as you hear while you're climbing the ladder?
It is, without a doubt, the most intense class of racing on the planet. Formula One has this ability to put pressure on you just by its very existence. It is so results driven that you automatically are pressured to get a result no matter what the circumstances. And that type of pressure, I think you have to learn to absorb it, live with it, understand it, potentially use it to your advantage. But without a doubt, it is the most pressure-filled sporting environment in the world that flushes out every strength and every weakness in every person on the team, not just the drivers.
Is Patrick Head really a knucklehead that you read in the reports?
Well, Patrick Head is one of those geniuses. He is one of those people who quietly thinks levels deeper than most people. He wants to know why it works, and how he can come up with a better, more efficient way to make it work. And he is fueled by this almost driver-like desire to succeed. I mean, after all these years, he doesn't need any money anymore. But after all these years, he's still fueled with this great desire to innovate, to develop, to prove, and really to again wave the flag of what he and Frank as privateers now can do together. And that, I mean, that desire, I think, to dedicate your life to that is part of what is part of what Formula One is. It's a lifestyle. It's not a job. It's a lifestyle.
How was Frank to deal with?
Frank was a very black and white person. Frank had no time for the emotion of the moment. Very businesslike, black and white. Really didn't understand that certain environments bring out the best in certain people. It was come in, work, do it right, or get out. There's plenty more people to come and take your place, which is understandable. Some drivers flourished in that environment. Some drivers didn't. And I think Frank is still the same today. He's still black and white. Still doesn't understand. For example, when Frentzen went there, Frentzen needed a bit of emotional support to get the best from him. Frank wasn't prepared to give that to him because he didn't understand what it meant. And Frentzen almost, his career almost died at Williams. He goes to Jordan the next year and he almost wins the world championship. So he had the talent, he just didn't have the environment.
Now, I remember you from your days with the Renault car, Renault garage door in IndyCar racing, and you had a big accident. What were the highlights for you in your IndyCar, and how much did you enjoy oval racing compared to Formula One circuit?
Believe it or not, oval track racing was a bit of a strange animal because, in a way, racing on an oval, particularly a short oval, with a really good handling car, was what you thought racing always should be. High speed, slipstreaming, passing, being passed, high action all the time. It's what you imagined racing would be. Road racing at the levels I did it is so fast, the cars are so stiff, they're so abrupt, they're so abrasive, they're actually hostile environments. They're physically difficult animals to drive. So oval track racing had this, just this satisfaction feel when the car was good. Now, on the other hand, when the car was bad, it was by far the scariest, unnerving, most dangerous environment you could ever put an athlete into, without a doubt. And I got to experience both sides of what that looks like.
What is your homeboy Eddie Irvine doing these days?
Growing his hair long, doing as little as possible, getting out of bed as late as possible, chasing as many women as possible, counting his money as often as possible, looking cool, and trying to prove to everybody that he could have been world champion if Michael Schumacher never existed.
Yeah, quite a few people can say that. Formula One season is about to start. I want you to give me settle this debate. People think Hamilton, and I asked Stirling Moss the same question, that Hamilton is, you know, spoon-fed success, everything worked out for him. How would you rate him as a race car driver?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, I'm a big fan of Eddie Irvine's. And I'll tell you what his greatest strength was, his mental strength. He absolutely mentally had it over most of his competitors. So, Hamilton, is he spoon-fed? I don't know. I don't really care. Because the beauty about motor racing is, even if you're handed everything on a plate, there is nowhere to hide when you have to go perform. When you're asked by yourself to get in, go perform, the eyes of the world are on you, all your strengths and weaknesses come out. So it doesn't matter what Lewis Hamilton had supposedly handed to him, and he had a good development path. Without a doubt, he is true world-class material that is potentially a model for so many people to follow. I love what he's done. I love what he's brought to the sport. And the level of intrigue that he has brought has replaced the level of intrigue that Michael Schumacher left when he walked away.
Who do you think will win this year, and who would you like to see win the championship this year?
The beauty about Formula One is you never know what's going to happen. After recent testing, who would believe that Jenson Button might win a race? He might win three or four races. If he wins three or four or five races, he might be world champion with a new rule they just instigated. If you look at past history, I have a sneaky suspicion that BMW are going to be even stronger this year. They just have a measured, controlled approach that they seem to execute at a level as high, if not higher, than some teams. I can't imagine that Ferrari without Schumacher will continue to be as technically advanced as they need to be. Ron Dennis has given up leadership at McLaren. I don't know whether that will affect them or not. So when you look at all that and look what Ross Brawn is about to produce, don't you think the intrigue of Formula One next year might be greater at a higher level than ever before? And will Alonso package it? And they say he's the safest hands in Formula One. You know, will he package a season-long ability to bring another world championship for him? I actually don't know, but it sure is a great amount of intrigue.
You must be a very proud papa these days. Your son Connor is doing very well. How much are you involved in guiding his career?
I'm very much involved with guiding Connor's career. I've been there, done that, made all the mistakes. So I try and use my experience to potentially guide him along a path that he tells me he wants to go along. No matter what I can do for him, at the end of the day, it's a bit like Lewis Hamilton. When a driver jumps into the car, he's by himself. So you then look at a driver, does he have... I mean, it's all great fun. Drivers love driving racing. It's great fun. Great to miss school for a week and go to Florida. But at the end of the day, you look at a package that is a driver, and does he have the innate ability that and to have the X factor, that little differentiating X factor that just puts him in a position to succeed, that allows him to rise to the top when it's necessary, to get the momentum, to come on song at the right time. And so far, all through his go-karting and his Formula Ford in Canada and his Skip Barber, he's been able to do that. Now he's at a higher level. The challenge starts all over again. He's immediately fast in the Star Mazda Championship, and we'll see what he learns. We'll see how far he goes. But I do tell him his success in the future will not be dependent upon the team or what I bring or what he brings or what sponsorship brings. It'll actually be on what he himself is prepared to sacrifice, what he learns, what he does, how he applies himself. That will be the ultimate determining factor on how far he goes.
I do want to ask you a question based on a word you use, mistakes. What were some of the big mistakes you made, or what is the most common mistake young drivers make that hurt them in their career?
From what I've experienced with many, many young drivers, very few of them understand the difference between a strength and a weakness. Very few of them would admit that they have a weakness. One of my biggest problems was I never knew I had a weakness. Nobody told me. I never understood it. So, nor would I ever admit it, because I wouldn't want anybody to even think of it. Little did I know, if I identify a weakness, work on it, turn it into a strength, and then add it to my natural strength, you become a powerhouse. And I find the same trends with young drivers today. So I wrote a book that was published about a year ago on driver development. And it's all about understanding the ingredients, understanding how to develop all those ingredients. And if you have weaknesses, which every driver has, work on it, don't bury it, expose it, work on it, develop it, and then you can potentially become the very best you can be. And let's face it, what more could you ask for but to become the very best you can possibly be?
Derek, I really appreciate your time. Finally, how about a message for listeners of F1 Weekly? And I'm very pleased to tell you we have listeners in your country also.
Well, I love the fact that F1 Weekly is on the internet, because you now have access to the world. My family in Ireland can now listen to this. Awesome. So keep listening. Send messages every now and then. Tell your friends to tune in, because you will get information here that few get access to, and it'll be broadcast around the world. I love it.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm here with a young happening dude of American motor racing, Connor Daly. Connor, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Excellent.
I remember your dad from his Formula One days, of course, from his IndyCar days. Tell me, motor racing, you know, is it all because your dad is a racing driver? What's your, you know, how deep is your love for motor racing?
Well, I motor racing is what I love most. I mean, I've played every other sport in America to do, and motor racing is definitely where my heart is, and it's just what I enjoy doing most. And it's great to have a dad who's been through everything in the motor racing world, and you know, he's a great asset to me.
Now, you were in karting. Tell us about your karting experience, and how long were you in karting?
Well, I did karting for since when I was 10 till about 15 years old. It was a good time. I won a lot of junior championships and won a couple national championships and then just slowly started progressing into the race car world, and that's been where my life's been going ever since.
Now, recently, you and Jeff Newgarden, Jeff or Joseph?
Joseph
Newgarden raced in Europe and had some success at the Formula Ford. Tell us about that. This was at Brands Hatch, right?
It was an incredible experience over there. We got to do the Formula Ford Festival at Brands Hatch and the Walter Hayes Trophy at Silverstone, and it was an amazing experience to go over there as Americans. And usually the Europeans picture us as less talented or you know, not as good as them. So it was good to go over there and Joseph win the festival and me win the Walter Hayes. So it was an incredible experience overall.
Now, up till now, how much single seater racing have you done in the U.S.?
Well, last year I did the Skip Barber National Championship, and I won that, and that was really my first full year in cars. The year before, I had done some karting and cars, but last year was really my first full year. I also did the Canadian Formula Ford Championship last year, which I finished second, Rookie of the Year, won six races in a row, the last six. And then now this year will be my first year in the Star Mazda Championship, so should be a good year.
Now, when you moved from karting to single-seater racing, what was the biggest adjustment?
Well, I think the biggest adjustment would be has to be the weight. The weight of the cars is so different to get used to from a small, nimble go-kart. and also the downforce. I mean, obviously, go-karts, you don't have any downforce or aero ability, and now in the Star Mazda cars, we have, you know, big wings and big downforce and high speed. So it's just, there's a lot to learn, and I'm still trying to learn as much as I can at a fast pace.
All racing drivers want to win. What is your goal in this Star Mazda series this year?
My goal definitely has to be to win. I mean, every driver wants to win, but you know, that winning comes with me being able to learn as much as I can as quick as possible. So if as long as I can get a lot of learning done in these first couple races and get some good points, and hopefully we'll be there at the end of the season to win the championship.
Formula One has to be the goal. What is your career path that you would like to do, let's say, for the next 3 years?
The next 3 years is kind of difficult. I mean, if I win this championship, then Mazda pays for me to drive in the Atlantic Championship. So, and it seems like that championship is on the rise again. So hopefully that would be a good thing for next year. And then after that, you know, I'd like to make the move to Europe. Hopefully this year I'll actually be able to start testing some F3 cars or something like that. And just kind of keep my foot over there and, you know, just start relationships with some people over there. So, it all depends on how much I win and how well things go. So we'll see.
I'm sure Dad can open or at least introduce you to a lot of people. But let me ask you a question. Since your dad has been there, he probably won't buy any excuse from you. Do you sometimes feel like, man, I wish my dad was not a racing driver?
I don't know. He has a lot of information to offer. But, you know, sometimes he does get on my nerves, I do admit. But, you know, he's always there to help, and his advice is always very helpful. So, you know, it's great to have him around.
Based on a little racing experience you had at Brands Hatch, when you race overseas, do you feel the difference in the level of aggression of the drivers? We're talking on the track, or the depth of the talent?
Well, I think America has a lot of talented drivers as well as Europe. It's just a different style of racing from country to country. But it's good. I'd say that the level of aggression is definitely different because of the different rules that they have over in Europe. I mean, there's obviously a lot of defensive driving allowed over in Europe, and in America here, not so much. So it was good for me to learn and get used to the defensive driving aspect, and you know, it's really hardcore racing, really, is what it was. So, you know, it's great for me to, you know, put in my memory bank and learn for the rest of my life.
Okay, now I have a few questions. You have to give me one or the other, okay? Lewis Hamilton or Fernando Alonso?
That's a difficult one. I definitely like both people, but I think Lewis is who I'd like to see winning from now on.
Milka Duno or Danica Patrick?
Oh, Danica Patrick for sure. Danica, she's a good driver and a good looking girl as well.
Good. Now the season is starting very soon. Formula One. What are your expectations?
Formula One will be definitely an interesting season with the new Ross Brawn GP team setting some quick times in testing. That'll be it'll be interesting to see how well they do in race pace. But I mean, I can't wait to see the season start. I mean, the cars are a bit interesting looking, but it should be a good season.
And finally, how about a message for listeners of F1 Weekly Worldwide, please?
Oh, my website's www.connordaily.net. And you know, hopefully everyone can see me progressing the motorsports ladder, and I hope to meet a lot of people along the way.
And don't forget the F1 Weekly and the poor people of Paris when you make it to Formula One.
Oh, I will definitely not forget.
It's now on record. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Derek and Connor, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now as we go into the wrap-up, Nasser, we've got an email.
Yes, sir. This is from one of our regular listeners, Jeff Klein. And I remember this gentleman from his racing days. And he sent me an email and some very interesting experiences. And I just sent him an email. I said, man, the kind of experiences you have, I'm coming down to L.A. to talk to you. Very good stories. But he sent me this experience he had with Sir Stirling Moss. And this was at Goodwood. And I'm glad that he shared with us, and I would like you to read this in your broadcast voice, please.
Thank you, Nasser. The interview with Stirling Moss, his real character, really came through. I never spent much time with him, but in 2002, I was at Goodwood driving a C-Type Jag and a 1937 Alpha 12C. And during one of the races that require two drivers, I was standing on the pit box looking down at Moss doing a driver change in a Cobra. He jumped in and buckled up, and just when he was pulling out of the pit, he unbuckled the belts and left with no seat belts operative. Marcus Pye and I just looked at each other in disbelief. Moss is one of a kind. Your interview was amazing. Thank you, Jeff. Keep up the good work.
I want to thank everybody who tunes in. Good night.
Thank you, and bye-bye.